We are currently 6 minutes late. But the chagrin of the chair and everybody else. We're going to open a subcommittee of the committee, subcommittee of one right now of the committee, and hear testimony on House Bill 72. We have two witnesses, Don Butch from Lincoln County and David Leland from Department of Human Resources.
Human Services.
Thank you. Would you please come up? Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Chair Representative Jensen and other members of the committee. My name is Don Butch. I am from Newport. I own property in the foothills of the Cascades where my family has a summer home that was originally built on a homesteaded property. My father bought this log cabin house and remodeled and modernized it and willed it to me. My family enjoys this home frequently during the summer. We have to close it during the winter because of the freezing weather. Adjoining this property are several other such homes and one full-time resident with whom we share our water source, a beautiful spring which feeds us our water through a plastic hose of several hundred feet long. It was discovered a short time ago that the water rights we had did not include domestic use, and it specified fish raising, recreation, and the like. In the process of transferring these rights to include household and garden rights, we were asked at one point to obtain from Marion County a sign-off on the potability of the water. That request has been withdrawn. But we discovered then that any group of water uses that exceed four or more are liable to be examined by the Marion County Health Department acting for the state of Oregon. We could possibly be required to install purification systems, which would be costly and would likely require frequent inspection and attendance. Often months pass in the winter when none of us are there except that one permanent resident. That resident has their water tested once, more than once, and no problems have existed. I have drunk that water since my childhood, and so have my children and grandchildren, who have never, with never a problem or a symptom. In fact, Representatives Brown's son and his family have also drunk that water on a number of occasions. After speaking to the Marion County Health Department, I discovered that they are overwhelmed with work and do not investigate small groups like ours. We would likely make seven members if and when they all would utilize the water rights. We are currently five. They informed me that the federal government requirement for a water system is 15 users. We were alarmed about the shadow this casts upon the value of our properties when any of us would sell. A prospective buyer could be warned away. One of my neighbors is right now wanting to sell his house. Four of us use these homes as a second home and need to be cautious about possible expenditures we have had to make. In fact, we wonder if perhaps when my neighbor does sell his home, if he doesn't have to, within the rights of the real estate rights, he wouldn't have to identify this problem exists. Without really searching for other people who share similar circumstances, I am acquainted with two who feel that their second home, is somewhat compromised in value, one in Tillamook County and one near John Day. I suspect there are many such groups throughout the state. I greatly appreciate the kindness of Representative Brown in introducing this bill, and I would be grateful if the committee passes.
Thank you.
If I answer any questions, if you may.
Don, weren't you before the Water Committee 2 years ago?
Our bill never got heard, sir.
Never got heard?
No. I remember speaking to you about it, and you wanted to attach it to another bill, and that the closure came too soon.
Closure came on us too soon. Okay. Just trying to refresh my memory on the history of the bill, because I do remember the issue and the situation. Are there other questions? Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very
much. Thank you
for your testimony. Representative Brown is I'm sure regrets not being here, but he's out of the building on a field trip. with his other committee, so he's a good friend, and I'm sure he knows where you're at, and we'll be here to give us information later on. Dave, Leland, please.
Chair Jensen, thank you. I'm Dave Leland. I manage the public drinking water program for the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today representing Gail Shibley, who is the administrator of our Office of Public Health Systems. And I've distributed a little written testimony, but I think I just want to make a couple of points here this afternoon. The bill here is about what I like to call non-EPA public water systems. In other words, they're brought under our authority by our state statute, but not under federal law. And so what we're talking about here are systems that are between 4 and 14 connections, 10 and 24 people, 60 days out of the year. As this committee has heard before, our overall program resources are insufficient, really, to do the job that we have at hand. And currently, House Bill 2171 is being worked in this committee right around those issues, as you know. And in fact, really, even if more resources were available to us, these non-EPA public water systems are lower priority in our overall scheme. And we really have to focus on the EPA water systems and the current EPA rules, as you've heard from our Drinking Water Task Force in their report earlier. Therefore, our department is neutral on this bill. And let me just tell you that, you know, we don't work on these water systems now, as Mr. Bush pointed out correctly, just due to a lack of resources. But I do want to say we do care about the drinking water that these people are drinking, and you know, there are at this time we've identified just about 1,000 of these very small water systems statewide, and that's really without looking for them very much. And they serve a total of about 16,000 Oregonians, and we do care about the water that those people are drinking. But as program managers, we also have to be serious about program priorities and realize that we don't have all the resources to do everything, and we do have to make choices and do the most good for public health what we have to work with. So sadly, this is kind of what it's come to. Let me just say in concluding that really the practical effect of this bill really is only that it would remove a responsibility that we just are unable to carry out with our program resources at this time. I will tell you, too, that I did run this by our representatives at EPA just to make sure that, you know, this doesn't cloud the primacy issue and the Safe Drinking Water Act stuff. And they were kind enough to run it by their legal counsel and didn't see any problems from their standpoint. So I think with that, I'll conclude and just be happy to answer any questions or provide any other information that the committee might have. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for Dave?
I do, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I understand. You don't have a problem with the bill. It just means that you would continue not to do what you're not doing now. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Tomei. Now, I will say that, we are public health people. You know, if people call us with a drinking water problem, or if we hear people are getting sick, you know, we're going to try to help people. It's just that we wouldn't have the authorities in place that we have now under statute.
Thank you. Thank you,
you're
Mr.
Welcome.
Chair.
Another question?
I have one, Mr. Chair. Regarding resources, Dave, and I appreciate that you're very limited in your resources. I mean, do you have any sense of how many FTEs it would take to fill that gap that we're talking between the 4 and what's being proposed to raise it to the 15? I mean, we're talking one more FTE in every county. I mean, what for 16,000, if you can give me a sense, that would be helpful.
Yes, Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder. Yes, I in fact I brought with me too another handout, which is our drinking water program advisory committee priorities work that they did a couple of years ago here. And so let me answer the question two ways. First off, the straight answer to the question is at that time we estimated that it would take five FTE to really do the envisioned oversight program for those 1,000 water systems, and we're guessing we don't know all of them. There could very well be many more than that if we went looking. So that's the first part to the question. The second part of the answer I'd like to give is going back to the task force report. If we had more resources, would we put them here? And the task force recommendation, as you'll recall, is that that we need a lot more resources to do the work on the EPA systems and the current EPA standards. And they were very honest, I think, in their recommendations that they didn't have the answer to that gap about the small systems. There were two things they didn't address in their recommendation. One was the non-EPA systems, and the other thing that they didn't address was future EPA standards, and felt those were just outside the scope of what they were looking at. But I think what's important there is that the question is, if we had five more FTE, would we put them here? And I think the answer is no. Mm-hmm. You know, if we got our other needs taken care of, then that might be something to look at.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dave.
Question? Is there any possibility of privatizing this service or this function? And I'm thinking in relationship to, and it's kind of the other extreme, but to the Water Resource Department's request 2 years ago and a bill that we had to eliminate the sunset for this year, of privatizing some of the applications for permits that go through their agency, especially those large permits that take a considerable amount of time. And they have outside contractors that they have now available for some of those, that individuals who wish to bear the burden of the cost of those outside contractors themselves are able to have this take place. What are the possibilities of a similar sort of legislation or similar sort of program with something like this?
Chair Jensen, I think one of the things that I think we probably have difficulty with there is that this is a regulatory program as opposed to like a permit program or something like that. The drinking water program oversight really has to do with...
You have no oversight when you're doing nothing.
Well, that's true, yes. And so then the question would be, well, do we, you know, tell water suppliers they have to, you know, hire somebody from a list to inspect their system or look at their test results?
No.
Maybe I don't understand.
You're missing my point. We're not telling them that they have to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, they can do that now. There are plenty of professionals in the business out there that do drinking water construction work and do you know, work on people's wells for their houses. And so I think, if I'm understanding the question, I think that service is out there for people who want to have some help with particular problems or have someone look at their system and tell them, you know, what, you know, they might need to do to make it a more healthy water system or a more safe water system.
Mr. Chair, are you talking about the voluntary, the receipts authority?
Pardon me?
The receipts authority that currently DEQ and the Water Resources Department have, where they can charge an extra fee in order to expedite their program?
Mm-hmm. But they do so through, it's done so through private contractors.
Correct. I guess the question is, Dave, I mean, are you, at this point, I'm just trying to clarify what I think the chair is asking is, yeah. This is a program where somebody can come apply for a permit and pay extra to get their permit expedited.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
The question is, though, are you charging a fee? I mean, that's what I see as the difference here.
Mm-hmm.
Are you charging a fee for these inspections? or is it part of a service that you're, you know, that the health department's providing because they're inspecting these systems? I think that would be the difference.
Okay. I think I do understand the question. At the present time, you know, we don't charge a fee for inspections, and that is part of the 2171 bill.
Correct.
Our other difficulty is the vast majority of our funding is actually from EPA, and so we have a problem with using those funds for non-EPA systems. You know, we have an audit problem with that. You know, I think the receipts, as I understand the receipts authority, that is a way for people to kind of come to the front of the line by paying an extra amount.
Correct.
And so, you know, we don't have that base amount right now. Okay. So does that
help? I would like to ask you to have a look at House Bill 2186,
okay,
and its predecessor from the 03 session, and to see what the concepts are that I'm talking about, and
okay,
we'll deal with that when we meet in the, if and when we meet for a work session on this bill.
I'd be happy to do that. Chair Hansen.
I'm told by my staff that it is scheduled for a work session on Monday.
Okay. And that, I'm sorry, and that bill number?
2186.
2186.
And its predecessor,
mm-hmm,
in the 03 session, Section 4, Chapter 745 of the Oregon laws of 03.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, yes, of the committee, Dave, I'll email you that information before the end of business today.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
And I'll be prepared with something on Monday.
Okay.
Thank you.
Or before.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2472, and we will open the full Water Committee now since we have a quorum present. And we will proceed with opening an informational meeting from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the specific topic of discussion today is the coastal coho evaluation process and assessment project. And we have Director Lindsay Ball of the ODF&W and Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And if we could, please, gentlemen. I might say, as we welcome them to get set up here, that this is a presentation that we have looked forward to having now for, in my limited legislative memory, at least 8 years. Thank you, gentlemen. Please proceed.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here before you this afternoon. And Chair Jensen, 8 years, you're correct, and I'm glad to say I think we have some results to reveal to the committee today that are very positive. We provided our last update to the committee during the interim in November, and a few things have happened since that time, which Ed will bring forward in just a few moments. But the Oregon Plan represents an unprecedented statewide effort to protect and enhance our fisheries and our watersheds. I still say, when I look around the country, I cannot identify another state that has gone to the extent and the effort that Oregon has. And the effort has been based on the executive and legislative leadership coupled with on-the-ground actions by our land-based industries, local landowners, stakeholder groups, and just Oregon citizens. And I think that's very important to note. We are approaching the 10-year mark in the effort of the Oregon Plan. The Coastal Coho Project assessment that we're presenting to you today was the beginning, and the coastal coho was the species that became the catalyst for the Oregon Plan. The coho has been heralded as a tremendous sport fish, table fare, prized by many chefs and families at the dinner table. It's a very important icon to the state of Oregon. A key part of the assessment that we have conducted with respect to the COHO provides the best possible information to the federal government as they consider the coastal COHO as a candidate species to be listed or not. It's currently not listed. It is a candidate species. That was a result of Judge Hogan's decision several months ago now to bring that thing off the list. It was put back on for reconsideration to be placed back on the endangered species list by the federal government. Regardless of the listing decision, both the state and federal governments are committed to developing a full conservation plan for coastal coho that goes beyond the minimum viability and achieve the Oregon Plan objectives. Legislature leadership has been and will continue to be essential to this success. And Chair Jensen, your leadership last session, as well as Vice Chair Representative Dingfelder, resulted in statutory clarification of the definition of recovery. That has been used extensively as we have proceeded with the coastal coho assessment. I'll turn the rest of the presentation over to Ed Bowles so he can walk you through some of the details of our draft assessment of the coastal coho viability and conservation efforts. And I will interrupt Ed as we go through this presentation at some point and describe a little bit about the effort that this agency pursued last September when Ed and I embarked on a very rigorous and ambitious schedule to get this assessment completed in time for consideration by the federal government. I'll be a little descriptive in some of my storytelling so you can understand some of the dedication by some of the people of the staff of ODFW. But for now, I'm going to turn Ed loose and let him go start with the presentation. Ed.
Director Paul, I'd like a brief interruption here after I get my tongue straightened out and know who I'm talking to. And certainly the legislature and the chair, and I think the executive department all appreciate the accolades that we have received from you this morning, but I think the real accolades for the success that we've had here go to fundamentally the people on the ground, the people who have been out in the field there, working on this, and who have been there with their support and encouragement, grumbling maybe sometimes along the way, but still have been there. And I think that this is not a story of success so far as the governor's office is concerned, nor is it a story of success as far as the department is concerned, nor as far as the leadership or whatever it was of the legislature, but it's a story of success of the people of the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. As Director Ball mentioned, I'm going to walk you through some of the results, a little bit of background, and then the results of our assessment. I was asked by the committee administrator to present kind of a focus on the results that the independent scientific multidisciplinary science team is currently reviewing, as well as other folks right now, of our draft report. And so there will be a lot of information here. I will follow your lead, Chair, as to just how much you want to get into it. But I have provided the full slides of this to give you a taste of just some of the scope that we've been looking at. The full draft reports that we have are actually over 700 pages. It's a very thorough assessment, and you can link that over the web and peruse at your interest. So hopefully we can at least just give you a taste of what that has.
And also, you have an hour and 29 minutes.
So Chair Jensen, I very much hope that we don't need that.
And he doesn't. Don't feel obligated to use all your time.
I'm sure that he will probably have more than that if he needs it.
Chair Jensen, duly noted.
Okay.
But you did say 7 years in the making, so. Basically, as Director Ball mentioned, there are three key parts to this assessment. The Oregon Plan assessment, which is really just a matter of an assessment of where we're at with the Oregon plan, using Costa Coho as an example of that. And it's really important with something as high level of commitment to this Oregon plan that we do take the time to self-evaluate for adaptive management of that program. There's also, as Director Ball mentioned, the listing determination of these fish this spring, and then building into a full-blown conservation plan. The presentation today is going to focus on that middle bullet, the actual documents that are informing the listing decision. We're looking at two things. One is just the status of the fish themselves and their viability from a biological standpoint. And then the other is kind of the breadth of conservation efforts on the ground and how effective those are dealing with the threats to the fish. Start by just giving you a picture of what the fish are telling us as far as adults. This represents a graph of adults over the past 50 years. And this is all of those fish. This doesn't necessarily mean those that are coming home to spawn, but these are the adults produced out in the ocean, basically available potentially to come spawn. You'll see that there was a dramatic decline and a very welcome rebound here recently. And a lot of folks have thought that, well, the cornerstone of our analysis is on the simple fact that these fish have come back, therefore they must be fine, let's go ahead and not need to list them. The actual focus of our analysis is in this unprecedented downturn that we saw during the 1990s. From a biological standpoint, that's what we're most interested in. How were the fish doing then? How did they come out of that? And what were they telling us across their watersheds? The reason we are able to provide this analysis to you is because of the strength of the Oregon Plan Monitoring Program. Without that, we would not have been listening to the fish during that unprecedented period in their lives. You'll see this is the primary cause of the decline that we occurred in the 90s. This represents the ocean variability. You can see for the past 50 years, very positive ocean conditions, kind of cyclical pattern. But in the 90s, unprecedented downturn in the past five decades. Now, this also represents somewhat of a perfect storm in that it not only represents poor ocean productivity issues, but it also occurred with two significant droughts coupled with a 50-year-plus flood events in 1996. And so during this period, the fish were probably tested more than they've been tested in any recent period. Luckily, we happened to be listening during that period.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get an idea of what those ocean conditions were. I mean, it talks about the small to adult survival, but what are the sort of conditions that lend themselves to that?
Chair Jensen and Representative Dalto, what that primarily represents is a change in the upwelling patterns in the North Pacific and off the coast of Oregon and the other shelf. And so what happens is you have changes in those current patterns and the upwelling that occurs, which brings the nutrient-rich waters down deep that are very cool. Those nutrient-rich waters come up off of the shelf of Oregon, off the coast, and that is wonderful feeding grounds for other little organisms that then crescendo up into the food for the coho salmon.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
The coho that come out of the coastal streams, do they stay right there off the coast of Oregon, or do they migrate further up the coast?
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, coho are not as widely distributed as some of the other salmon species or steelhead. Some of the salmon, the spring Chinook salmon, as well as a lot of the steelhead, will venture all the way up into Alaska, all the way around to Kamchatka in some cases. Coho are more locally oriented and distribute themselves in a kind of coastal framework, north and south.
And follow up. And so the improvement in ocean conditions right off the coast of Oregon, helps our coho salmon that are going up the...
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, it does help ours, but it helps... It the conditions off of our coast area affects all salmon because all of the young fish, as they come out of our tributaries, have to experience that. And it's early in their life that makes some of the biggest difference in their survivability.
Mr. Chair, could you go back to that, please? Ed, thanks. So I'm curious about... You talk about the perfect storm, and certainly we know about the floods of 64, 65, and I can't remember other droughts, but I assume there are other droughts. So why was it so dramatic in those years, late 80s and early 90s, as compared to, say, 40 years before?
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, it's driven primarily by what we call a Pacific decadal oscillation in ocean currents and the upwelling associated with those, similar to what I was explaining to Representative Dalto. That is the primary driver, is that oscillation. You can see a kind of pattern to this. Nested within that are your occasional droughts, floods, things like that that occur on a more random basis. But the driver is those upwelling, nutrient-rich waters. Are they there when the fish need them? Are the temperatures the right temperatures for the fish to survive?
Follow up. So that continued 7 or 8 years. It looks like it peaked or went down.
This?
Right. It looks like it's about over, what would you say, 7 or 8 years before it changed. Is that correct?
Yeah. Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, the real downturn hit about 7 to 9 brood cycles. Brood, when the fish come home to spawn, they hit them real hard for about 7 to 9 years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown. Is there any way to weight the changing in the ocean conditions with the work that was done on the in the watershed areas as to the recovery? In other words, if they hadn't done all that work up the on the watershed areas, would the recovery been as improved as it is now? Or if we just left everything along in the ocean, would it solve the problem itself?
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, most of this recovery that you see here is a result of the improved marine survival conditions. We don't have a real direct way of teasing it out, absolutely, but we do have, in some of our analytical approaches, a way of standardizing the marine conditions so we can just judge what the fish are doing independent of the marine, and that was one of our key pieces of analysis. Now, as far as your question regarding the efficacy of the actual conservation efforts in the watersheds, we do have other ways of measuring that, and there's no doubt in my mind that those efforts in the watersheds not only helped dramatically the fish survive the downturn, but helped give them a springboard to recover rapidly from that. It's not just habitat actions, though. A big part of that were some changes in fish management, particularly harvest management, and I will get into that in my presentation.
So, Ed, you might mention about some of the core areas of inland habitat that we saw that was very important for rearing and spawning.
Yes, as Director Ball mentioned, during the period of the downturn, this period here, what we found was very essential was the remaining areas of high-quality coho habitat. And for coho, the most important habitat for them is, and I'll speak to this a little later, is kind of low gradient channels with wide valleys with a lot of complexity to the riverbed, meanders and alcoves. And this is important for the fish during their overwinter period before they head out to the ocean. And those high quality areas that Oregon still has left were really the bread and butter producers during the major downturn, and a good indication for us as Oregon Plan implementers of what we need to do to ensure these fish are here in the future, to shore these up and enhance these areas. Chair Jensen, we're right on track here.
At this rate, we'll get out of here about 6 o'clock.
Now, one of the first and obvious things to do in this sort of analysis is to define actually what it is we're managing and analyzing. And so this represents the Coastal Coho ESU, which is the Evolutionary Significant Unit termed by the federal government. It's from Cape Blanco all the way north towards the mouth of the Columbia River. Represents all those coastal watersheds between there. And we have 19 populations within that that become really our unit of management. Those 19 populations are what we're going to be looking at to see how well they're doing. Now, there are a lot of other populations as well that are much smaller, but they are dependent on these bigger populations for their long-term sustainability. So these 19 populations were critical. We looked at the fish from several different perspectives. We call these fish performance attributes, and we didn't want to just look at them from one standpoint. And so you look at abundance, their productivity, which is their survival, basically from one parent to the next parent generation. We looked at their persistence over time. Are they going to still be around in healthy levels? And their distribution and diversity. So all of these perspectives we look at simultaneously at these fish to make sure we're not missing something. I'm not going to go into a lot of the analytical side of this. I'll mainly talk to you about results, but I do want you to appreciate one thing about the coho that's very important to this analysis, and that's their ability to be very productive when their densities or their numbers get very low. So as the pressures of a poor ocean or other things knock these fish back, they have within themselves, not only within themselves, but within the habitat still available to them, the ability to fight back to those adverse pressures by having much higher productivity at low densities. And so the effect of this graph represents the density of spawners. So the more spawners you have, the further out you are on this end of it. And this represents the productivity of the fish. The higher it is, the better the productivity is. So the higher the density, the lower the productivity just naturally of these fish. And then as you slide back towards concern, their survivability goes way up. And so what we're interested in looking at from an ESA listing standpoint is at these low densities, how are the fish doing? Do they have the ability to stabilize at low densities to get them through these downturns in environmental conditions? We're not so interested in what's going on up here because we expect them to be not very productive at high densities. Not that much different than agricultural models.
Would you explain your R-squared, your correlation?
Yeah, what this R-squared is simply it is a measure of how well the relationship is to the correlation. So how much of that variability that you see from this line, this is the actual data and the points, and then you have a line, and how spread the data is, how much of that is explained by the relationship. And for this particular one, 50% of that variation is explained by the equation, which is quite good for biological systems.
Okay, I guess that was what I was looking for in the answer. The degree of significance of your
Yes, these relationships, I don't have the probability value on this, but most of these relationships that we found have significant relationship between this high spawners versus low spawners and their survival. So this is, for coho particularly, this is essential to their ability to persist. So that's why I brought it up.
Do you have that information somewhere else?
Chair Jensen, in these reports, okay, we have it.
Thank you.
Ad nauseum in these reports.
that's what I meant. That's fine.
One other approach that we took to this is an obvious question, which is what's the probability of these fish persisting into the future given all the variability out there, including the downturn in ocean that we just recently saw? And so we took a combinations of their habitat and their productivity, and we modeled that out for 100 years, given the downturn in oceans that have occurred in the past. And we're able to develop a curve, which we call a viability curve. Anything to the right of the curve means that you have less than a 5% chance of dropping down into these areas that you'd be concerned about extinction. Anything to the left of the curve means that you're equal to or greater than a 5% chance of getting close to these extinction levels. And so we're able to do this for each of these populations because of the strength of the data. In this case, this is the Nakanakum of the North Coast. You can see that it lands just to the right of the curve, so therefore it has a low probability of being in trouble over the next 100 years. Another very important piece of this is the distribution of these fish, and particularly we're able, because of the strength of the Oregon Plan Monitoring Program, to get this fine-tuned to these levels of what we call isoplus, where we're able to actually look at these fish and how they're distributed each year across the landscape. The redder the color, the hotter the color, the worse it is for the fish. And the cooler the color, the better it is for the fish. You can see back in the late 90s, as we're heading into the depths of this effects of the poor ocean, you can see the North Coast in particular, some of the mid-coast, very much in trouble with respect to low densities of fish. Now remember, as they dropped into these low densities, we're still able to analyze their persistence. As the ocean conditions moderated, we expected them to kind of stair-step their way out of this hole. Instead, they surprised us, quite frankly, showed remarkable resilience, and they pretty much just made a quantum leap out of the hole to a point where by 2003, we went from, in this case, 30,000 total fish to over 220,000 total fish. We are currently, the last couple of years, at about 150,000 or so. The dark areas aren't necessarily meaning there's no fish. It's just the distribution data wasn't collected for that. So there's a lot of analysis that went into this, but I wanted to jump to what were the results of applying our criteria that we developed to the actual numbers of fish and their productivity. This figure, we're not going to walk you through this, but what I want you to look at on this is we've got all the populations on the left and the different strata that each population were in. And then these across the top are the different ways we were looking at the fish. This is one way of looking at productivity, another way of looking at productivity, the persistence over time, their distribution, their diversity. And all of these, when any time a population failed the criteria, any one of these, we rolled it over into a failed status all the way over for the combined. So we were very precautionary in this approach. The yellower color is still a pass as far as our criteria go, but we wanted to indicate those areas that didn't pass with flying colors. And so those are simply near passes, okay? And on the right-hand side, you'll see the combined for those where we had five populations that failed at least one of our criteria, and then the rest of them passing. Yes, Chair Jensen. I didn't know if you were asking.
Oh, no, I'm following the stats now, the data down.
This shows you, just from a map standpoint, where those populations that failed at least one of the criteria occurred: the Tillamook, Salmon, Siletz, Alsea, and the Upper Umpqua. And down in the Floras and Sixes, which are very small systems, we did not have enough data to be highly analytical with that. Now, we had to then roll that population results up into results that would speak to the entire ESU. From a ESA standpoint, you manage at the ESU scale, and so is the ESU viable? So we had criteria that rolled it along, so we had to have at least over half of the populations that actually passed all of the criteria, and we were able to succeed at that. And then we needed, within each of those five strata, we needed at least two of the populations passing all the criteria, and we were able to pass that as well, with the Umpqua being 50% because there was only a total of two. And from that, then, all the strata pass, and therefore you have a designation that the ESU as a whole passes the minimum viability criteria, which means they are likely to persist into the foreseeable future.
Mr. Chair?
Representing Butler.
Thank you. Ed, I apologize if you said this already and I didn't catch it, but the criteria that you were using, was there a weighted system? Did they have equal weighting, or were there certain criteria that had, you know, were weighted more heavily than other criteria?
Chair Jensen and Representative Dingfelder, what we did was we actually took a much more precautionary approach, and we said any criteria that you didn't pass, you ended up failing the whole population. So we actually had 5 or 6 different criteria, and so if anything failed, you automatically failed. And so a weighting system would actually be less precautionary than that approach.
And what were the criteria? I mean, do you have that in the presentation, or is that something you can...
We absolutely do, and it would, I felt it would take too long to walk you through all those, but it goes through, each one has its own level of risk factor, what the metrics are to measure it, and everything we had to select, of course, had to be, and this is something that was brought out in the definition of recovery, was whatever was selected based on these attributes, and you'll recognize those attributes from your definition mm-hmm. of recovery, it all had to be measurable. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And so each one is got a metric associated with it. And then we had risk factors within that. And if I go back, I'll show you which one, Representative Dingfelder. You'll see that probably the one most sensitive to failure was the persistence one where we're modeling out. And to me, that's probably the most important one, that plus the productivity measurement here.
Thank you.
All right, so I want to just show you some what-ifs real quickly. This represents the model, the persistence out into the future, and these are the populations that didn't pass on this. In this case, it's 4 for the persistence. I want to show you just this middle shows you actually what we think is going on with respect to what we've already done in reforming and changing our hatchery practices along the coast. We do not take any credit for this in our analysis because we haven't empirically measured it yet, but we do have studies that show the impacts of competition and other things related to some of these hatchery programs that we were able to, we've already made those adjustments. They were part of the Oregon Plan mandate. And so we predict through our actual studies that this is the current risk that we have just as a result of those hatchery issues. These are not changes we have to make in the future. These are ones that have already occurred, but we have not taken credit for that in the analysis. It's just another way of looking. I also want to draw your attention to the far right column. This shows where we would be right now with respect to risk to our populations if we had not managed our harvest responsibly. Back historically, and I'll show you this in a minute, we were harvesting these fish primarily in the marine environment, averaging 70% harvest. This shows where we'd be today if we had kept that up with almost all of the populations at risk, particularly in the northern part. And so that as a component of responsive management, adaptive management, has been very important in allowing these fish to persist.
Could you go back and kind of repeat all of that for me, Ed? Make sure that I understand it.
Okay. This column represents our current analysis that we submitted and that we used in our conclusions. The center column represents where we actually think we are with the existing effects of our hatchery program changes as a result of Oregon Plan implementation and our hatchery policies. We have not, even though we have studies that give us this information to predict this, we haven't measured it on the ground yet, Chair Jensen, and so we're not taking credit for it. This represents where we'd be today if we had not changed our harvest practices from what they were in the past decades.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown. Then the hatchery changes there, essentially closing down the hatcheries on those tributaries there? Is that what you mean?
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, as I'll show you in just a little bit, I'll show you exactly what we did, but it's a number of different things. shifting from out-of-basin sort of broodstocks to within-basin broodstocks, reducing the numbers of fish that we've been releasing, as well as changing the areas that we're releasing those fish in to make sure they come back to the areas we want them to.
And then the third column then is adjusting the fishing seasons in the marine environment as out in the ocean, the commercial seasons and the sport seasons there.
Chair Jensen, Representative Baum, that's correct. It's not so much adjusting the seasons so much as it is shifting to a selective fishery that targets on marked hatchery fish and lets the wild fish go.
That's the reason I had to turn them loose then.
That's correct. Now, this using that model that I showed you of persistence, remember, anything to the right of here is bad, anything to the left is bad, anything to the right is good. I wanted to show you one of the populations. This is the Tillamook that I said had failed, one of those. This is where it lands in its persistence. So it's got just over a 5% chance of getting to those extinction levels in the next 100 years. This shows actually where we calculate it is if we were to take credit for the hatchery changes right now. And then this shows where that population would be if we hadn't changed our harvest practices analytically. So it's quite a dramatic effect that those conservation efforts have. This shows all the populations and just how sensitive, because it, you know, we don't want to look at this just from the standpoint of where we are right now, but allows us to play some what-if games. This is where we're at right now based on our assumptions and our models and our analysis. Now, we can dial down the marine conditions and say, what if ocean survival is 15% worse in the future than it has been in the past? What's going to happen to the populations? You can see as you dial it way down, you know, to somewhat absurd levels, which is only, you know, 90% reduction in the health of our oceans, you can see that all the populations are at risk. What's remarkable, though, is some of our southern coastal populations are almost bulletproof. It's quite remarkable how far you can push these. Now, conversely, it also shows us, as we dial things up through more focused efforts within the Oregon Plan and other management activities, how we can also benefit and reduce risk as we move along with implementing the Oregon Plan. Now, that's the basic stuff related to the viability analysis that we worked so hard on. Now, there's a whole other section to this, huge another section to this, that relates to the evaluation of the conservation efforts that are going on related to the Oregon Plan and all of the management activities. And I'm going to walk you through that next. I think Lindsay wanted to talk briefly beforehand, but I want to just touch on some of the things we're looking at relative to all the conservation efforts out there.
Thank you, Ed. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, what I wanted to bring to your attention, all the graphs and the charts that you've seen previous to this were accomplished in a very short time frame by staff at ODFW. And we had engaged in a process to look at the viability of the coastal coho salmon in conjunction with NOAA Fisheries Technical Recovery Team. Quite frankly, it appeared to Ed and I that we were not going to meet the deadline for reconsideration of a no-list decision on coho. And so I assigned the task to Ed and the staff, who commenced work on evaluating the persistence and productivity, etc., that he has displayed to you today. They worked nonstop, 7 days a week for 7 weeks straight. And I have to tell this story because I think it represents the effort that they went through. One morning, Mark Chilcote woke up, and this is 2:30 in the morning. He goes over to his computer because he was thinking about some population models. He gets on his computer, and he's working out these population models, and he thought, well, this looks pretty good. I'll send it over to Tom Nicholson, so he'll have it when he gets up in the morning. He fires it off to Tom Nicholson. Unbeknownst to him, Tom Nicholson was sitting at his computer at 2:30 in the morning, so instantly he bounced it back to Mark, and they continued to work on the population model in the middle of the night. That kind of commitment, I think, mirrors also the commitment by the people of Oregon that got us to where we are today in a collaborative, cooperative effort to restore fish in Oregon. I said when the Oregon Plan started, the cooperative collaborative effort would be the key, and I think it is. I think it's demonstrated by the results that we have today. Thank you, Chair, for that. I wanted to brag a little bit.
Director Ball, the Chair appreciates and is happy to have those comments on the record for your staff and your personnel. The only question we have is that I suppose, are they just a bunch of young men who are computer nerds that just stay up all night playing with their computer, or are they scientists that are motivated by the science that they're dealing with? We don't have to get into that.
One of my fears is that they are of the older generation. In fact, people like Tom Nicholson is looking at retirement here in the next few months, and that worries me because there's a lot of talent and a lot of experience walking out the door.
Can we introduce a bill that would deprive him of his PERS so that we can keep him around?
Well, you might do that.
Go ahead, please. Thanks.
And once again, I'd like to reiterate that this has really been a collective effort, and what I'm going to branch into now is the work that was done. As Lindsay mentioned, this is really a cabinet-level effort that includes all the Oregon Plan partner agencies and all their staff. And what was done was, you know, everybody is doing a lot on the ground in addition to all the private interests, land-based interests and others that are doing remarkable things and trying to bring all this data together. You know, we've been at this for nearly a decade, and it hasn't really been brought to bear on just what it is we're accomplishing. And so a big part of this, regardless of what happens with respect to the listing decision or anything else, is just the fact that it's forced us to take a look at what we're doing and how well it's going and how we're organizing our information. And I want to really give credit to these other agencies for them stepping up to the plate and really providing leadership on this. The next part of this that I'll present is actually from slides that Jay Nicholas from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board has put together, who are their firm partner in this whole effort. This represents basically what I'm going to call a storyboard, and it's just a way of organizing our information because there's too much out there. So it shows you, this is at the whole ESU scale. This represents the ESU, and then there's bits of information here that describe the key elements of the ESU. Now, I should mention that within this ESU, there is 19 populations. And so for each population, you'll find a storyboard just for it that breaks it down where you can see all the relevant information for each of these populations. And so I'm just going to touch on some of this to show you. Let's first take a look at this area of the storyboard, and up here, what is this telling you at the ESU scale? What we have is, this is the final conclusions of the biological analysis that show the ESU with the strata, the fact that it passed the criteria with a pass for the northern strata and a pass plus for the southern ones, and the overall designation. Then you can go up to this section where you can get some very useful information on land ownership. This is very critical because this shows the potential for future change and improvement. This shows basically all streams within the ESU, and it's basically about 12,000 miles of streams, but not all of those are coho streams. Well, the ownership of land, let me go through this real quickly for you. This is federal forest, state forest in the lighter green, and then the real dark green is private forest. Then you have other, which is just a catch-all, urban and private agriculture, and these different across the bar. So it shows you relative to 100% for this all streams what the dynamic is. As you go into coho streams, which is about half of that are coho streams of the total, you'll find that the vast majority of land ownership is actually in private forest and agriculture, a little bit in urban, and then a fairly good chunk in federal forest, smaller in state forest. But as you go up into the high intrinsic potential habitat, that stuff I talked to you about earlier, you'll find that there's much less of that. What is available, though, is this quality habitat that got those fish through the downturn. And I should mention, this difference here is not necessarily due to deterioration. A lot of this, the vast majority of this, is driven by just basic geology. Okay? Coho don't necessarily like the V-shaped valleys and high-gradient streams. They like the low-gradient, U-shaped valleys. And so when you get that down there, it's mainly driven by geology. Here's your land ownership of that. And so what that does is it helps us understand what are the participants and the stakeholder interests that are going to be most vital in helping us move forward with conservation issues. So you can go from there, take a look at another part of the storyboard to give you the detail of this. This just shows, I wanted to just show you, this shows Chinook abundance relative to coho. What I wanted to point out here was that, remember this graph I showed you right at the beginning that showed the coho going down and then coming back up? What I did here was break it out by spawners actually on the spawning grounds versus what was harvested. And if you look, because of the high harvest rates during these decades, right now we actually have more fish coming home to spawn than we've had in over five decades right now, even though the total number of coho is less. More are spawning than we've ever had in the last half century.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Tony. Maybe you're going to lead up to that, but why is that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, this part of the gray portion of this are legitimate adult fish, but they're out in the ocean and they're caught before they come home. So what we have done now is we've removed that constraint by letting the wild fish go. So all the wild fish, for practical purposes, all but about 10% of them are able to now come home. And so that's a part of it. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, we move on now to what I've personally been touting all the time, which is monitoring. The investments, getting this sort of finger to the pulse of the fish is not cheap. And it is an investment that you're well aware of and been supportive of. We've had to the tune of just under $16 million invested in listening to the fish throughout all the different agencies and the different ways we have of collecting this information. Down here, we look at restoration activities on the storyboard. Total restoration funding, $107 million for the ESU, and these are on-the-ground activities occurring to benefit the watersheds. Okay, you can see the different types of restoration activities from roads, fish passage, riparian, in-stream, all through there. The restoration yearly totals, the restoration funds by region, and then the source of the funds. So it's a way of organizing all that information that's very useful in tracking the progress and how the state's money is being spent.
Mr. Chair, I know we don't want to be here until midnight, but I just want to make sure, thank you, that I'm understanding, going back to a previous slide about the high coho potential areas, so much of that is in private ownership, right? That we're looking at private forests and also farmland. Am I correct interpreting that?
Chair Jensen and Representative Tomei, you are correct. That is the nature of coho and their preference and why it is so critical that Oregon has something like the Oregon Plan operating here, because if you simply were looking at the Federal Forest Practices Act, other things, Forest Plan, you're not going to get the job done. It's through that private partnership that we're going to make or break coho, and that's why the Oregon Plan can be so touted in that.
That's why we were trying to say at the beginning that it's really the people of the state of Oregon.
Right, the private citizens who own this property.
Okay. I had a question on this. Of all of the, have you been able yet, and you may not have been able to do this, but have you been able yet to look at all of these various and sundry measures you have there, riparian or fish passages or roads, do any type of a multiple regression analysis on which one of those is most significant? And the reason question is, that could, if and when you're able to do that, that could provide you know, real helpful information for us when we get down the road looking at the next population that we're dealing with.
Chair Jensen, not only that, but it allows you to tease out the bottlenecks for the fish, mm-hmm. what management tools the best to address that, and allows you to prioritize funding, which is very critical to OWEB and others that are funneling this money to the folks on the ground. And I'll get into that a little bit in just
Thank
a little
you.
Bit as far as those bottlenecks. Another one, actual OWEB grants. It's actually not a real big part of the overall greater than $100 million spending, but you've got nearly $23 million through grants. We show the different types of those grants going out, with the vast majority of it going to restoration on the ground. And then just to give you an example of where those on-the-ground restoration is occurring, and the beauty of these storyboards allows you, and this is a web-based system that you'll be able to access, where you'll be able to go in and look at specific areas and find out exactly where the different types of restoration activities are occurring on the ground to benefit the fish. Then we also have a section here that describes what the fish are telling us, or what the habitat's telling us here in the middle. And I'll just point to a couple of those. We talked quite at length, and Representative Tomei brought up the fishery harvest rate issue. This basically shows you what we used to be doing, averaging 70% over here during this period, of where 70% of all the adult fish were caught before they could come home to spawn. This shows you where we're at now. Okay, it's single digits basically. This shows the river, how many fish were taken out even after they came home before they spawned. And this shows you where we are now. So through our responsive management of our fisheries, we've been able to basically zero out, for practical purposes, this limiting factor. We talked about hatcheries earlier, and Representative Brown, you had asked the question. So this shows you actually on these storyboards exactly. Now, this is at the ESU scale. We can also show it at the population scale. This shows you all the releases of fish that we've had, and these are the ODFW hatcheries. And we've basically gone from 9 million down to 1 million. But even more significantly, look at the drop in the private hatchery programs off the coast. Now, this is not something that we as a state or an agency shut down. The market shut these down when the ocean turned around. And this was a market-driven system. And we have statutes and rules that regulate these sort of coastal salmon hatchery programs. But this was a significant reduction. We went from over 30 million total coho being released into the system to 1 million now. And yet the fish are doing very well and the fisheries are healthy. Stray rates into areas where we don't want the hatchery fish to be going to spawn, we basically are now down into, once again, the single digits for those areas that were concerned about stray rates. But it has bounced around a bit. I don't know how much detail you want to go into, Chair, on some of the other factors, but there's habitat complexity, which I mentioned to you. This is probably the most important to the fish as far as opportunities in the future and their bottleneck. This is that basically meandering, braided sort of channel with lots of little alcoves and calm water in these low-gradient areas, typically in the lowlands, that coho need to get them through the winter. Without these, what happens is you get a winter freshet, and these fish end up getting moved down into the estuaries too soon to really be able to deal with the salt water and be ready to feed in the ocean. We find that these are not, we have not been able to detect a downward trend in these, which is very important to us, because the first thing is we want to stem any decline in habitat conditions. So far, we have not been able to pick up a trend over the past 10 years of any downward slide in the quality of this habitat. That's very good news. And as we move forward, we want to actually, through our restoration activities, enhance these habitats. But right now, the current habitat is sufficient to allow those fish to persist. So given that, we want to make sure it's not deteriorating. And right now, that's the case.
R.J. Brown.
The coho spawn in, not necessarily in the main stem of the creeks and the rivers, but up the tributaries, is that right, as opposed
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, that is correct. Your spawning areas are much further up in the system, but also in tributaries low down. But typically it is not main stem if you're talking about bigger river systems. I'm just going to not really give you the specific data, but you have those on your slides. But Fish Passage, there's been work done on Fish Passage, as you're well aware. It's been one of the priorities of Oregon Plan measures. This is, relates primarily to culverts connecting fish to their spawning areas. Water quality issues, we were able to assess that. Once again, each one of these has an appendix report developed by the regulatory state agency responsible for it. And so you've got, in this case, DEQ that did an exhaustive report on water quality issues. Water quantity through Department of Water Resources, we were able to look at this and assess it from a limiting factor standpoint. And then all the other risk factors, there's a whole grab bag of these, including pinnipeds and predators, all the way up to dissolved oxygen, pathogens, things like that.
Did you take into consideration that the chair of the committee has been mitigating for the last 10 years and not going out and fishing for or eating any Oregon salmon?
There may be a correlation, Chair Jensen, there, but we didn't put that into our analysis. So.
Do you want to go there?
Director Ball can fix that.
Before then, or... Please.
Now, one last place I want to point you to on this overall storyboard are these two columns here, and this gets at what Chair Jensen was referring to when we're trying to determine the bottlenecks. This shows you at the ESU scale, in 1997 when we first started this, and this was also the federal assessment, we basically didn't know a lot, and so we assumed that everything was bad. Marine habitat, fishery harvest, hatchery impacts were a medium button. The bigger the button, the worse it is, okay? Stream complexity, which is that overwinter channel complexity, fish passage, water quality, quantity, and other factors. Basically, needed to do everything. And in response to that, the Oregon Plan went out and did everything, okay? Trying to do good things for fish, you know, on all fronts. What we now know, and this doesn't necessarily mean that we've necessarily fixed all these, but a lot of it's a change in perspective as a result of the analysis of what you were very speaking to, Chair Jensen, the analytical framework to determine what's ailing the fish. We find we're able to hone this down. Some of this has actually been fixed now. Marine habitat, it's what we're looking at in 2005 is rather than the bottleneck, what are the restoration opportunities or priorities? Where can we get our best bang for the buck? We can't really influence marine habitat. We've already fixed harvest. We've already fixed most of the hatchery impacts, except on some special cases. Stream complexity is the number one area that we have opportunities in the future to do good things for the fish, and also some water quality in some habitats. You can see it's allowed us to much more focus where we're going to be the Oregon Plan priorities. Now, this does not mean that you stop doing other good things, and it doesn't mean that on localized basis you may not have hatchery impacts as your number one place. And in fact, if you look on this next one, I took the five populations that failed, and let's say you wanted to say we want to turn those from red lights to green lights. This shows you for each of those five populations what the biggest opportunity for corrective actions are. You'll find generally stream complexity is an important one, but in the salmon and in the upper Umpqua, you have hatchery practices that need to be addressed, as well as in the Umpqua, water quantity and quality, and water quality in the Tillamook, Alsea, and upper Umpqua as moderate sort of factors. Now,
what does stream complexity mean? What do you mean by that?
Chair Jensen and Representative Brown, that's a term that refers to the part of the fish's habitat that they use to kind of rear in, particularly during the winter that they stay in freshwater. These fish stay about 1 year in freshwater, and overwintering is a very important time for them. Stream complexity are, if you've ever seen streams with a lot of wood in it, beaver dams. You've got things like little side channels and alcoves that the fish can get away in. Good in-stream cover and good meander patterns, things like that. That all goes into stream complexity. Another thing that goes into that are freshwater wetland sort of areas. Coho really like that for their overwinter period.
Follow up. Then in the Tillamook, that must be the whole drainage there then, because I think there's four or five rivers come in there in Tillamook Bay.
Representative Brown, that is correct. We lump those together.
And then the water quality there, would that be because of the dairy industry in that valley then?
Chair Jensen, Representative Brown, we did not assess any causative sort of agents. The primary source in the actual reports, I think, is primarily non-point, but it's temperature related for the most part. And so it would be, and once again, I want to put this in context. Where this really leads us, because of our assessment that these fish meet minimum viability criteria, what this does is this information allows us not only to help prioritize Oregon plan activities to go beyond minimum viability and the health of the watersheds, but also allow us to move into a full conservation plan with some priority and focus. And before we would ever do that as a state, we would involve a full public process with all the different stakeholder interests to help sort out just where we want to go from here with respect to balancing improvements in fish habitat and survival with the other land-based interests and others. Just quickly on conclusions, the ESU does meet minimum viability criteria. This does not mean that they're firing on all cylinders. This means that with respect to the criteria we established for that minimum viability, they will persist into the future. The major factors for decline have been stopped. By these, I mean the real large issues like overharvest, like splash damming, things like that, loss of lowland habitat from, you know, the sort of things that occurred throughout the last first half of the century. The ongoing threats to viability are being addressed through Oregon plan structures. We've got the infrastructure in place to deal with that. We have secure and stable funding to deal with that, and management on federal lands with our federal partners. And so that infrastructure is in place to address those ongoing threats. Moderate risk remains from two primary factors at the ESU scale, that being the ocean conditions and the stream complexity. But once again, we feel that we have provisions in place to move forward on at least the one. Current management plus restoration activities should preclude serious deterioration of fish and their supporting habitat. Greatest restoration opportunity, as I mentioned, stream complexity, and once again, because of the strength of the monitoring program, we do have the ability to detect if these fish slide back down again and can respond accordingly through adaptive management up to and including bringing the federal government more actively involved. Okay, we're almost done. This is just now the technical review that we're going through. We've got the Oregon Plan partners. The IMST is currently reviewing this. We're getting input from NOAA Fisheries that'll be occurring, as well as input from the federal TRT in an ad hoc fashion. I didn't mention our stakeholder team. We do have a cross-section of resource interests. Most of these all reside in the coastal area. They have been meeting with us for over a year on about a monthly basis, where we're able to walk them through this, and they will be very important to us as we move into the full conservation plan, where they're going to actually help us describe the sort of values that they want expressed in the watershed as we build, go beyond to meeting more of the Oregon Plan objectives. And I think we do have some of those members there, or folks that have been participating on that in the audience today. Timeline, comments on the draft by mid-month, so that's coming right up. Final to NOAA Fisheries by the end of April. They will probably do their determination June or July of this year. And then the conservation and recovery plan, we hope to have a draft done by the end of the year. Thank you for your patience. That's all I have right now. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Observations and comments. The appreciation of the chair for the hard work that the agency has gone through, into to get us where we are today on that. I certainly want to commend the director for taking the bull by the horns, if we can skip from the streams to the prairies of eastern Oregon, and for his leadership and for your leadership too, Ed, as you've followed through on that, and I want to personally thank the members of the agency who are working for you or working for us, as they put obviously an incredible amount of effort into this in the last few months that it's taken you to do this. I genuinely appreciate that, and I don't know any other way really than to say it like that and leave it. We are indebted to you, and it is certainly a fine example, I think, of public servants, public employees, going beyond what may sometimes be perceived as their normal workload type of thing. So we do have, I think as we all understand, a couple of obstacles that are left in our way. Before we get to that 800-pound gorilla up in seal up in Seattle or wherever they're residing at, we've got to get by our assessment by the IMST. And members, you will be having a report, report of the IMST report will be presented to us on Wednesday of next week. So we'll have that information to go on, what they will be passing on that will go on to NOAA Fisheries, and then the technical recovery team, I guess that's the right, TRT, is that correct, which is a federal team, is another one that is going to have to review this, and I assume they're probably going to be looking at your full 700 pages along the way in that. So they get a little more in depth than we have been able to here in the committee, or probably than most members of the committee would like to get in there.
Right.
We could send it home if you have four or five copies of it with each member and have a quiz on it on Monday. That would be one possibility. And then, of course, the agency or the federal agency itself has to make its analysis. And given the fact that this is a 700-page document and you put months and months and months into the preparation and the work, it will take them a little time. And I would be hoping for some kind of a decision before the legislature's out. But colleagues, I'm not going to try to drag my feet and keep us in the building another month or two beyond what we normally would have, just to make sure that I hear that before we leave here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If it's okay, I'd make a comment that this in recovering the coho salmon, coastal coho salmon, as Representative Tomei pointed out, that on that one huge partner in this was the private landowners, and I think it should be acknowledged that those private landholders, by and large, are large timber companies. You know, the people that we think were the great big ugly gorillas that were causing all the problems, but this time they're part of the solution, and a huge part of that. That's the Boise Cascades, the Weyerhaeusers, and Simpson Lumber Company and Longview Fiber. Those people played a huge role in that because most of that private land is their property.
That's true, Representative Brown, and we do owe them, appreciation for their contributions and their efforts, as well as the efforts of the, the little guy out there too, that's been on the streams. But yes, I appreciate you're not letting me get away without giving some credit to those folks, and I appreciate Representative Tomei's comments on that too. Representative Dingfelder.
Well, while we're giving kudos, I think we should thank the lottery players of Oregon for funding the Oregon plan, not to leave out the little folks who are funding a lot of the private efforts, but all kidding aside, I do appreciate all the work you've done. I have a question regarding the timeline that you've set out, and it says here that the technical review, is this ongoing at the same time the IMST review, NOAA Fisheries, the federal TRT, I think it's back under the technical review slide. Yeah, one more. So is this all going on simultaneously, or is that a phased review, or how does that work?
Chair Jensen and Representative Dingfelder, this is all occurring simultaneously because of some of the deadlines that are in play with respect to the requirements for a listing decision. But I want to just clarify that the federal TRT has actually not been tasked as the official body to review our draft. It's actually being reviewed out of the NOAA Fisheries Office, Protected Species Division in Portland, and their Science Center in Seattle. They are getting input informally from the TRT, and the TRT has been working very hard since we had to basically break from them because they weren't on the same schedule necessary to get this done in time. They have been working very diligently since then, and I am quite optimistic that they will actually have a parallel assessment that hopefully will be ready before a final decision is made, and so that the federal government will have that to look at as well. We have scientists that are supporting them in their effort on that, and they are providing us ad hoc feedback.
Okay. Can you have a follow-up on that?
Follow-up.
So you're expecting comments back from them and then to turn those comments around, address the comments, whatever, and get it back to NOAA Fisheries?
Yes, we're doing this somewhat, Representative Dingfelder, in an iterative fashion. The NOAA Fisheries has listed our draft comments in the Federal Register, and so it is part of their due process. The public is commenting on that draft. That is why those comments were actually due the 11th, and then that NOAA Fisheries will turn around, provide us their initial comments by the 15th, and then we will turn around, digest all the comments, redo what's needed to be redone, and get it back to them by the end of April for them to take a couple months before final rulemaking. And I am not aware of whether or not they will re-notice it at that time.
And one final clarification, Mr. Hello. Chair. As far as your response to NOAA Fisheries comments, will that be in a public document? Will you put that on your website? Is that going to be part of the CFR?
Chair Jensen and Representative Dingfelder, our response to all the comments will be our final submittal. So that will be replace the draft submittal, and it will be the official document that rolls out.
Okay.
And I want to emphasize again that, this really is a collective effort, and this is going out under the governor's office, not ODFW. This is the governor's office that will be submitting this on behalf of all the state agencies.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Ed, one further comment or one further question, and I'll comment later. Let's take the scenario that the feds agree with us and delist based on your or our presentation to them. What do you do then in relationship to the coastal coho? What happens after success?
I think Director Ball may want to speak to this a little bit as well, but from my perspective as the state's primary fish manager, we move forward exactly with what we're doing now, doing good things for the fish, using our monitoring information to help adjust those things to make sure we're doing it in balance with the other needs, and move forward with completing a conservation plan for coastal coho that allows us to more fully meet Oregon Plan objectives. Now, along with that, we would like to shift the Oregon Plan, obviously, is much bigger than just the coastal ESU, and our fish management activities are much bigger than that, and there are a lot of other places in the state that need our attention, and we would like to take this approach and dedicate concentrated effort in some other areas to bring, you know, we don't have as good of information, but we can certainly bring together a thoughtful analysis of the status of the fish relative to those recovery sort of attributes, and duplicate this effort in other places. And we've identified a couple key areas, one of which is Mid-Columbia Steelhead that we would like to get into next.
Director Ball, do you want to speak to that question?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, I think Ed's covered it pretty well. The one thing that we're going to continue to do is make sure that we don't slip backwards with the coastal coho as we continue our monitoring of that fish. But as Ed has shown you on some slides, we have identified the bottlenecks for coho, and we can now start specifically channeling our efforts and our funding to those bottlenecks, and then spread our other resources out across other ESUs that are in trouble. And Mid-Columbia Steelhead, in my estimation, is a good one to take a hard look at after we resolve the issue with coastal coho.
Thank you both for your answers, and that was what I anticipated or more expected. I think there are two parts of the question that basically I was concerned with. One of those parts is that if we are successful, that we take the model and move to another stage, another species, another listed unit, and begin to replicate it there. If and when we're successful at that level, we continue to move on, so that if the model is that we have is successful over a period of some number of years, we will have, let's see, 700 and some pages by the number of, we'll have several trees invested in the simple containing the documentation, but we'll have a way to work with all the state. The first part of the question, and you've both spoken, I think, well to that, is to put aside the fears that some would have that just because we've had some degree of success here, that we walk away from the coastal coho, proclaiming our success and let them go ahead and deteriorate and go to extinction, instead of doing what the Oregon Plan would call for, continued monitoring and a continued observation of that particular ESU, so that if there is any slippage, we're there to respond as quickly as the slippage occurs. And I think that's important for all of us in the public to understand that success doesn't mean that that's the end of our watching over the particular, because at least in part it's my understanding that it's a function of the Department of Fish and Wildlife to manage our species. And managing them doesn't end after you have recovery. Manage them continues on and on and on. Is that guaranteed annual income for you? If there are no other questions, again, my sincere thanks to both of you, and please tell all of your staff we're very proud of it. Thank you.
Indeed.
With that, we're adjourned.